more or less fit it on the head, that the safety factor of having to pin up. Before I go any further, would you like to say a few words, Paul, to us about what's going on in the hinterland, as I call it, up there in the sky, Paul? We haven't heard anything about it in the last few weeks from you. So before I pursue this any further, maybe you'd like to say a few words. You're still there, Paul. WS2N, this is K2KEY in the TechNet.
Oh, okay, Mal, very good. There's been only a few things that I've made note of over the last couple of weeks. Things have really quieted down lately. Just a few milestones. The Spirit rover on Mars passed the fourth year anniversary on the 3rd of this month. So another week or two. Opportunity will cross that milestone as well. Still operating here. These things were supposed to run. They would have been happy for 3 months. Now they're 4 years and still going. Going into a winter on Mars. Again, another winter on Mars, actually. This will be its second big winter. And setting up the solar arrays. The Spirit got over this one hill and they wanted to point toward the sun and the best they could during this winter. It's like, you know, the sun gets low during that period of time in the, on the horizon, and they don't get much sunlight during the day. Days are shorter, so it'll probably go into a rest mode for the next quite a few months. Other thing I wanted to mention was the EVA for Expedition 16 might take place at the end of the month. You might remember a couple of months ago talking about this gigantic Alpha Rotator, they call it, on the International Space Station. These big solar panels rotate. There's a starboard and a port. Gigantic 240 by a total of 80 really feet, 240 feet by 80 feet. You have one set on the starboard side, one set on the port side. Will rotate to track the sun on a regular basis, kind of like a gigantic paddle wheel. And every hour and a half as the space station goes around the Earth, this thing will be rotating at a rate of once every hour and a half. They discovered quite a few months back that there was some kind of metal filings on the starboard side, and they believe it has to do with this motor that operates this thing that goes into the gear. So they have a new motor up there, I believe it was brought up by a Progress ship, and they're going to be replacing that, and that might be at the end of the month, depending on when the next space shuttle, STS-1.2, gets up there. That has been delayed, so if the shuttle goes at the end of January, probably maybe no earlier than the 24th, of January, if it goes during that week, then this EVA will be pushed back further. They can do the EVA without the shuttle on board, attached. They do this all the time. That motor will be changed out after the shuttle has gone back to Earth. That'll be a couple of week mission. The purpose of that mission is to bring up the Columbus module to attach to the Node 2. They call it Harmony. They gave it a name, Node 2. That was brought up last time. And that will increase the size of the workspace, the living space of the space station by quite a bit. So roughly that's about it. Quite a few other little things coming up, but Nothing imminent that I know of right now. Just basically these three main topics. K2KY, WS2N.
Paul, I do remember not too long ago an astronaut went out during an EVA and did what I call a sewing job. Wasn't there a tear in one of the solar panels where a separation had taken place and he brought it back together doing some kind of an operation a little bit like sewing, if I remember correctly, or maybe he used some kind of a fastening clamp. And I vaguely remember he had to do it very carefully because the total voltage he potentially could be exposed to could be at a lethal number. I probably have some of the details mixed up, but I wonder if you could give us a couple of words on that particular repair EVA. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, that was last EVA. Last time the shuttle was up there, they needed to do that repair. They opened up the... Well, what happened is one of the solar panels, the original one that was put up there, that was attached to the center of the International Space Station, that was a temporary location, kind of like temporary light on a new construction building. That was just a temporary location to be moved at a later time. The later time finally arrived during the last mission. Last mission was, one important part of last mission was to bring up this Harmony node thing, 15, 14 foot diameter, 22 foot long, Lego type of connection, which were attached to the space station, and they're able to attach many different other things to this one particular node too. Like I mentioned before, bringing Columbus up the module boat by the European Space Station. That was the main purpose of the last mission, but the other part of the main mission was to relocate this temporary 240 by 40 foot solar panel from the center of the space station out to the end of the space station. You bring it all the way to the port side or the south side, I forget which, but it had to go to the end, and then it was, you know, attach it, and then after it was attached, they had to open it up, unfurl this thing. It was all furled up from previous missions. They had to unfurl it, and when they unfurled it, it became torn near the end. Well, they got this one guy, he's 6'2", astronaut that was in there, and he was able to rig up some kind of a button and needle type of thing with an arrangement to hook the end of the panel that was torn, actually torn, it was actually pulled and separated from the main cable. Taut main cables that go all the way out, and the panels wound up getting disconnected from that. His job was to repair that. He needed six different hooked big washer type setup to accomplish that, to pull that back. And it looks good. You know, when I saw pictures of it, I mean, it looks perfect. It's direct repeater.
Okay, I heard everything on the input. The last 45 seconds or so, we lost to that. What was the highest voltage do you believe he potentially was being exposed to, and did he have to take special precaution for that, Paul?
Okay, I didn't know we were back to the courtesy tone. Very good. Dick was at 100. It's 100 amp capability, I think it is, for the solar panel. And I think that's 100 volts. I think I'd have to go back and research that one. 100 amp capability. It's either 100 volts or 1,000 volts. I don't know. I can't remember that. I'll have to research that one for you. But it's up there. It's labeled. The amperage is there. You know, I mean, total capability is 100 amps. You have four sets of these things, so you're looking at 20 amps or so per set. And he's fooling with one panel. That's 10 amps on a one panel. One half of one panel, probably 5 amps if you get that.
And anything above 100 millivolts, 100 milliamperes is potentially lethal.
So it's 320 volts.
Okay, 320 volts at 1,000 amps is 32 kilowatts they're getting out of those solar panels. My goodness, is there enough hardware on board, Paul, to require 32 kilowatts?
I think it was 100 amps. Sure. Not only did I plan on supplying all this equipment, the Russian living module, they call it the functioning cargo block, that's the next piece forward, the Unity, which is the first node, that's another section. After that, you've got the living quarters and lab Destiny, the United States module. Now you've got this other Unity module coming after that. I mean, this thing is going to have a room for like the equivalent of up to almost 2747s on the inside. After this Unity, they're going to, Harmony Node 2, they're going to be bumping the Columbus module on. Big living quarters in there by European Space Station. You've got Japan's module coming up this year. Coming up in a couple of sections. So, on top of that, what they do is that they shuttle docks in future missions when Orion goes up there, and they want to extend the time of these missions when they drop it. They've done this already on the last couple of flights. They could pick up the power from the space station. And for instance, let's say it's a 2-week mission by a shuttle. Instead of 14 days, now we can make it the way it is right now, 3 days more by jumping the power from the solar panels into the shuttle. When it's completed, then you have another solar panel up attached. They've got to bring one more up there. And these rotating motors are working correctly. You'll be able to add 6 more days to an existing shuttle flight. You might go up for a 12-day mission, wind up with an 18-day mission because you're tapping the power of that space station. That's how much extra power they have. And, no problem with the power once they get all these things on board there.
Would you like to move the question?
Okay, Glenn recognized. I'm going to make a guess here. What's going on is that when the space station can supply enough electrical power to a docked shuttle, the shuttle no longer has to run its fuel cells and burn up oxygen, which is one of the consumables, and that's the reason why the mission can be extended. That's one of my guesses. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, just a real quick question on the power dissipation. I guess one of the questions I've always had, I know with the space shuttle, they carry an awful lot of water with them into space. As a matter of fact, from what I understand, it's almost as much water on the shuttle as they do payload. And apparently they use that water and they expel when they're in space. They expel the water to dissipate from a lot of the things that can dissipate. Does anybody have any idea how they dissipate some of that power from the space station?
Okay, the panels, the doors of the cargo hold are huge radiators. As soon as they get on orbit, they open up those doors immediately, and that is the main radiator. And there's a fluid that's circulated through those tubes of the doors, and that's how they dump heat. they are not dissipating heat under normal circumstances by what's called ebullient transfer. In other words, a boiling off water. I think that's only an emergency procedure to be used during the period of time that the doors are not open. That's my guess. Let's see if Paul can confirm that. WS2N, KQLIW, wait for the beep.
Okay, this is WS1, and yeah, by the way, you're right, of course, the power is definitely going to supplement the use of the fuel cells for the shuttle. And yeah, I think they've got a two-day limit, maybe three-day limit tops. They've got a certain amount of time, whatever it is, to get those gigantic doors open with those 16 hinges you see the doors open, and then on the inside, if you look, it looks like an inner door almost, running the length of it. That's your condenser. You've got big air conditioning system, really. You've got the ammonia fluid going through that and dissipating heat that way. And once on board the International Space Station, heat is bad news. They've got to get rid of that. So you see all these gigantic solar panels. That's what stands out. But if you look close, there's a bunch of other panels that are coming off, that are unfurled, and they have ammonia running through them. And those are your radiators. And sometimes you hear about them repiping ammonia lines. You know, they're always out there. Every time another module is connected, or moved when they drop it. They're doing EVAs, they're doing power, rewiring the power, unplugging big cables, plugging them somewhere else. By the way, they've got big fancy plugs. They've got big handles on them to unplug these things. It's not like a big jack that we just pull in and out. Everything's bulky out there, so they designed disconnects and connect with like handles attached to them. And they have power, and then there's data cables that are relocating. They're also doing ammonia connections all the time. You know, valves and putting these quick disconnects into these ammonia fittings and extending the lines, the connecting lines to existing radiators. So there's radiators all over the Russian part of it, the American part of it. If you look at these black things, they're nowhere near as big as the working solar panels, but you can see them all coming out of the space station. They're running the fuel cells, and the byproduct of that is water. I mean, it's drinkable water. They utilize that water. Of course, they bring up, I think, 6,000 pounds of water every trip. They cut big bags, actually, gigantic floating bags, and they transfer them to the International Space Station. And, of course, they bring up water on the Progress ship as well. Back to you, WS.
One of the things you and I have discussed in the past, Paul, is the great big motors that are rotating the solar panels once every 90 minutes, because the International Space Station goes around the Earth once every 90 minutes, and the solar panels have to track the sun, even though the space station always keeps a constant orientation with reference to the Earth, to my knowledge. In other words, the same window is always aimed down at the Earth. Therefore, that rotary joint we now know has got 320 volts and 100 amperes. If that's going through slip ring in the hard vacuum of space, 100 amperes continuously going through slip rings that are continuously rotating 18 times per day. If I did that continuously, I know there's a finite life to those slip rings. And they'd be making metal chips all over the place and galling and doing all kinds of terrible things. Therefore, I am guessing that there's some kind of a magnetic transfer going on. And an inverter is the way that the power is transmitted through those rotary joints. We haven't been able to confirm the method that the power goes through those rotary joints yet, have we, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
I've read it somewhere, finally, on the internet. Probably saved it. I should look it up. My email's not working right now, believe it or not. Library system shut down. But no more stuffing that. There's big rolls in there. And their roller connected. And that's what they're doing. And they're going to rely on these. You know, they're spring-loaded, pushing against the internal part of this thing. And this thing is, I think, 5 feet diameter, if I'm not mistaken. So these things are rolling around roughly 15 feet. They're traveling roughly 15 linear feet every hour and a half, rolling around forever. One side is shut down right now, so I can change out this one motor. Hopefully that'll square it away. That's what I thought when I first heard metal shavings on the outside. I thought, Dick is going to be not happy when he hears this. It sounded like your scenario. Metal shavings. You know, maybe something wrong. But that is the thing that has to do with this motor. Originally, they did an EVA a few months back to see if it was hit by meteorites, to see if that was a problem, why this motor was drawing all kinds of amperage and everything. And it turns out that, by the way, these are AC motors. It turns out that they believe the motor is failing. And that's where this metal filings are coming from. We'll see. I'm still not sure. It still might be those rollers. In fact,
W2L repeater system.
That motor is probably a planetary gear motor. What do you think, Paul?
I know it's, and it's supposed to be operating the gimbals. I don't know, you know, these things are supposed to not only rotate, they're supposed to, how do you explain that? Change on its Z-axis, rotate it on its Z-axis. So, you know, it's not only do they go around 360 degrees, they're also supposed to articulate toward the sun. Now, I have figured out this motor that they're replacing does that because it is attached to a gimbal setup. So, I don't know. I haven't given any details. Details are very hard to get. With dial-up, it's more of a challenge. You need a lot of patience here. Go to the NASA site. If anybody's got dial-up, you got to wait like around, I don't know, 10 minutes before the homepage comes up where you put them up real quick. Anybody with dial-up, we got NASA dinosaurs back to you there.
Yeah, even with Firefox, I guess so many changes and upgrades have taken place. Yeah, I think you're telling me that the solar panels are steerable not only in azimuth, not only in elevation, but also in azimuth. At least they're gimbaled on two axes, if not three. And so 100 amperes is flowing through something that's got probably a 12-foot circumference. An interesting piece of mechanical engineering. And to properly lubricate a motor that's that large, with bearings that are that large, in the hard vacuum of space, I mean, bearing seal to try to keep that lubricant in there so it doesn't boil away into the hard vacuum of space. To have a lubricant that works in space, continues to work in space, and stays on station, that in itself is a difficult engineering problem. To find a conductive lubricant on those rollers or on those slip rings that are conducting 100 amperes at 320 volts, that's a serious engineering problem. But I can see one reason why they'd want to make it slip rings as opposed to a magnetic induction coupling, because a magnetic induction coupling would require a high-frequency inverter, and a 32 kilowatts of inverter is an extremely, that's pushing the state-of-the-art. To make a space-reliable 32 kilowatt inverter with all the backups required for it, wow, another tough problem. So I guess I'd rather live with the mechanical engineering problem of 100 amperes flowing through slip rings. And as they add more solar panels, the total current flowing through the slip rings is about to increase. And the fact that they got metal chips out of one of the motors and it draws high current says that they've either had a planetary gear failure or a slip ring failure. And probably a lubrication failure with one or the other. That's the reason why it's making metal chips, is my guess. I guess we'll eventually confirm all of these hypotheses here, Paul. Mel, I guess it's time to go to the next person on the list of your mailbag. K2KE1, K2RIW on the second hand.
Hey, very interesting. I always said that's why I asked Paul to give us a few words on it. And very good, Paul. I'm happy you're with us, and happy to be with you and the family especially. All right, let's read over a few more. Oh, by the way, you did mention HRU. Yes, that's coming up this week. And also Wednesday night, this Wednesday coming, Kings County Radio Club has a meeting at Floyd Bennett at 7:30 p.m. Everybody is welcome. If you'd like to come down to our meeting, plenty of free parking there. And nothing else, just shake hands with everybody, have a cup of coffee or tea and donuts, and no obligation. Okay, I'm reading over things here. I'm just reading over things here. All right, let's see. Oh, some months ago, okay, what do we do? Some months ago, you guys were talking about a power supply. And you mentioned that, Mel, you mentioned together that you were actually able to pick up power supplies that could run a 100-watt rig for little or no cost whatsoever. What are you talking about? You said you get the parts for nothing, and anybody can duplicate this. I'm trying to remember what this was all about, but the power supply. I don't remember. Let me think a minute. Oh, I think maybe I can come up with it. I think it was the discussion about salvaging the power supply for like a 100-watt transceiver and using as a power supply a salvage supply from computers that I believe that's it. Over.
I'm a little worried that a computer power supply... Well, let me backtrack. A modern-day 100-watt output rig probably draws 20 amperes, 15 amperes at least, close to 20 amperes on, let's say, 13 volts. I'm doubtful that the average computer power supply can give you 15 or 20 amperes at 13 volts. Putting a few of them together, maybe. Using computer power supplies to charge car batteries and car's batteries running the rig, yes. But I'm not convinced that a computer power supply will run a 100-watt rig. Correct me on that one if I'm wrong, Mel, go ahead.
4 amps at 12 volts.
Yeah, and 4 amps is not going to run. 4 amps is only going to run a 20-watt rig, not a 100-watt rig. So we're at least 4 to 1 or 5 to 1 shy on current as I see it, Mel, go ahead.
Hey, well, I'll tell you my experiment. I took a power supply out of the old computers that I broke up these towers. And the power supply was rated, I had one rated up to 350 watts. A lot of them were 250 watt power supplies, but a lot of them, even I found in some of the bigger old towers, were 350 watt power supplies, Dick, over.
Now, is that 350 watts all of the potentials added together? 5 volts at a zillion amperes, 12 or 13 volts at some amperes, minus 5, plus 15, and so on. Was there really 300 watts of capability on just the 12 or 13 volt output? I'm back to you, Mel. And if so, maybe that's a much older computer. I think the more modern computers may not run that high in power.
Definitely. Now, these are the old computers that you'll find in the street right now, like 286, 386, you know, the big old towers and all the horizontal ones. I took one of them out, and I saw it. It was marked right on it, you know, its rating. So I said, okay, let me substantiate it. Of course, you know, there's a ton of cables coming out of it. Basically, breaks down to two supplies, a 5-volt supply and a 12-volt supply. That's the two that was coming out of the power supply. So I cut away a lot of the cables and all because, you know, a lot of them just, they all go to the same point. They just go to these, you know, connectors that split it off to different portions of the different boards and all. And but basically it came down that, you know, I had two wires come out for 5 volts and two wires come out for 12 volts. So I went ahead and I started measuring across it, and I saw I wasn't getting any regulation to speak of with the power supply. And in delving into its design and all, the switching power supply, I found that you got to load down the 5-volt supply, heavy load the 5-volt supply down, and then it switches it to PWM and makes the pulse width modulator work correctly. And the son of a gun, the thing, I was able to adjust the little pot in there and all, come out with about 13.5 volts. And I loaded it down, and I was able to draw 15 amps from it, Dick, over.
Did you like you with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just from power supply design days, many of the old switching power supplies that were used in the computers, exactly as Mel said, the main regulator was the 5. So if you put a very small preload on the 5 just to bring the duty cycle of the pulse width modulator out to, full pulse width, then you can load down the 12. You can actually pull the majority of the load that most of those apply to the 12, but don't draw any more power off of the other outputs. Furthermore, some of the newer power supplies, P4, they actually use more power on the 12 volts. There's actually a 4-pin connector that comes out on the other side to supply the main part of the board. Some of those you can certainly get at least 20 amps out of in case you do like you.
Very nice to know. How about that? What percentage of the computer power supply do you think, Mel, are capable of that kind of beam? Go ahead.
I took a number of them apart. I was amazed. I was able to use a number of them for making up those power supplies. In fact, a number of them I saw easily pulling 20 amps out of them, and they still were 12-plus volts open without a load. They were 13. I've got one adjusted up to about 13.5 volts, and under a heavy load of 20 amps, Dick, I was able to still keep the voltage at least 12.5 volts, over.
And I bet you're going to tell me that the 13 volts was quite well regulated, not very much ripple on it, even though the switching power supply is running at, let's say, 100 kc. Go ahead.
Exactly. I looked at them carefully on a scope. I looked them on a spectrum analyzer. Wanted to see if any glitches there or whatever, because I didn't want no surprises, you know, on the receiver and say, what the heck is that noise? You know, because it was a disengaging. Actually, I stuck the 706. I was using it as my 706 Mark II power supply, because usually I use that as a portable. I run it off batteries, or, you know, I can take it in the mobile. It's a nice little, you know, HF and VHF, UHF rig. Very, very nice little rig. So I wanted a power supply just so I could, you know, something neat and small. So I took one of those computer supplies and, oh, I dressed it all up. I made a nice front panel. I stuck two nice meters in there. I put a couple of nice binding posts on. I put a fuse in the front. I made a whole nice thing out of it. In fact, I took one meter. I got a couple of nice small backlit meters. One of them I shunted so it reads up to 20 amps. The other one I made an expanded scale so that the zero is 10 volts and full scale is 15 volts. Keep an eye on the voltage. You know, really be able to see the 13 plus whatever volts, you know, distinctly and see the difference in the voltage drop and all when you're talking to the mic. And made up a thing, sprayed it nice black, put white lettering. And you should see that power supply work. Then I did something different, and I'll tell you that on the next go around. Go ahead.
Very nice. Had a question I was going to ask you, but I forgot it. It'll come back to me. So those switching power supplies do the job very nicely. And the price is right, because people are throwing out computers like you wouldn't believe. One of the companies that I work at, it seems like once every year and a half, they throw out 50 tower-type desktop computers because they're upgrading them. Tremendous amount of hardware goes out the door. And so a smart person who can get his hands on a few of these and strip away the power supplies. In fact, I've seen individual power supplies yanked out of those computers, and separately those were thrown into the garbage can. And I can tell by looking at the power supply, it looks like it was fully operational. Somebody was using it for some kind of a temporary project. Back in you and my day, you and I used to salvage old television sets out of people's garbage cans to get parts. Now it's computers. Back to you, Mel.
That don't remind me. I just had enough of that junk down the basement, and it was packed with power transformers from TV sets and all that stuff. Oh, you name it. I had tons of that stuff, Dick. Dirt plus them all. Yep. Anyhow, I went ahead. I had got an idea. I wanted one to produce more current. I needed something. I wanted something, say, around 35 amps, Dick. So I re-engineered one of these computer power supplies to now get, at least double the current out of it, Dick, over.
Now, with a little bit of smart, you could combine the current output from two separate supplies. That would be the conservative approach. To take the raw rectifier that's in there, the filter capacitor for the main voltage that's in there, and the switching transistors, and to try to double their current capability. At first, that sounds like quite a bit of re-engineering is required. How did you go about that one, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, I plagiarized our good friend Manfred. He published that very nice article, you may have seen it in QST, on our power supply, his homebrew power supply. Did you see that article, Dick, over?
Oh, boy, did I see that article. December issue, 1999, and January issue, 2000, QST Magazine lead article. 40 ampere, so-called 12-volt power supply. Very well engineered. It was that power supply that allowed me and Manfred to start talking to each other. And what a relationship that has turned into. Back to you, Mel.
The time is 11:36 p.m. Welcome to the W2EL repeater. Good evening.
Hey, using that idea, I said, wait a minute, I got an idea. I looked at that design. I could say those transformers in there, the transformer in there, usually. I measured it. I think that one I was working with had a 75 kilohertz square wave going into that transformer. So I took out that transformer, and I made a new transformer using that system that Manfred had in that article. Made up my own transformer, used the transistors that he suggested, the high current switching transistors that work very, very, very well at the... They're called high voltage switching type transistors made by Motorola. I got a pair of them. I put them in. I changed the rectifiers that come into the radio, into the power supply. I pulled out the original diode and put in a, I forgot the heck that package I got that was rated, I believe, that's... I don't know, 10 amps I think they are, that package, a little square package, instead of the, the discrete diodes that they had on the board, just standing there on the board, the original diodes, I think they were originally like 3 amps. And that's what I did, I put that together, I salvaged, why not salvage the pulse width modulator, the oscillator, and all that stuff. It's all intact, works real, real well. PWM and everything really worked excellent, so I used just his output supply and supplied the rest of it, left it intact, and I took 35 amps out of one of these things after modification, over.
Fantastic. Now, in the case of, I'm not sure about Manfred, but I'm going to guess that in the case of a computer, you've got the equivalent of a bridge rectifier. You bought a bridge rectifier assembly, a four-liter device, whereas there were discrete four diodes on the inner circuit board of what you replaced. That rectifies the raw 110-volt line up to 167 volts, approximately. That goes into a zillion microfarad capacitor, and that's the raw voltage that runs the switching transistors. Now, the transformer itself, is there a secondary winding more appropriate to 12 volts of output? into high voltage, into high current shunt diodes that do the real rectifying into the final output? Or did they use pulse width modulation as a method of stepping the 160 volts, 67 volts down to 13? It seems to me like you would gain a little bit of that action by using a secondary winding on the transformer. I wonder which way they did it. Was it a bucking type power supply or a pulse width modulated step down transformer type? Back to you, Mel.
Followed along the original design of the power supply, basically just as you described, the rectifiers come in from the line to approximately whatever it brings it up to, around 170 volts, 60 volts, whatever it is, and has, I could say, a couple thousand microfarad across it. And then they go in and they have an oscillator circuit, pulse width modulator, oscillator, you know, it's a whole, it's actually a little area of that board, you know, with toroids on it. It's very well constructed. You look at those power supplies. They have a fan built into it, the muffin fan, of course, in the rear. And what I did is I just left all that intact. I beefed up the rectifiers that on the line because they were only rated at 3-amp diodes. And I also, the rest of the filters and everything I left intact. I took out the transformer, that 75 kilohertz transformer in there, and I replaced it with my homebrew transformer that I made up. And I replaced that transistor that drives that transformer. I replaced it with two transistors, Dick. The secondary, it comes off the transformer. I, of course, replaced the diodes with new diodes that Manfred suggests. I was able to buy those diodes very cheap. Those are dual Sakti diodes. They're 100 volt, 30 amp diodes, Dick. And, like I say, it worked out real well. It's not a, you know, a very complicated job. It's boy, for nothing almost. You have a tremendous power supply over.
I'm going to guess the computer inverter is single-ended. Or did you make it push-pull? I know that Manfred Mortenweg, his power supply was push-pull. Is the inverter on the computer power supply single-ended, or is it push-pull, Meldred?
Single-ended, yeah. Of course, they have a very simple, you know, little device sitting on a heat sink that stands up on the board. You're gonna have to, in other words, when I remade it, I couldn't put it in that, use the original cabinet. I took all the original cabinet. I made, basically, salvage the board in there. I put the whole thing into another box. And that's what I'm on right now. And it had to be, you had to make more room because you're going to have to put larger components in. But you're salvaging so much of it, you know, you got all that, like I say, the PWM and everything. You're just, you know, you're just really, you know, beefing up everything on it, Dick. The oscillators and everything like that don't have to be touched, over.
Glenn recognized part of what Manfred had to do to get enough iron in the transformer is he stacked a couple of ferrite transformers together on top of each other and then wound windings around the whole work. I wonder if you had to do that. Over to Glenn first, and then Glenn, you pass it over to Mel. QIQ, KQLIW.
Yeah, just real quickly, most of those computer power supply supplies are called forward converters. Basically, the switching transistor is basically just conducting in one quadrant of the transformer. And as far as getting the transformer large enough, certainly you have to worry about the amount of current capability in the wire, but typically they are getting closer to flux density. When the core has to actually get larger, it's because if you reduce the number of turns, then you need more cross-sectional area. Over to you, Mel.
Of course, that's the whole idea of how they came up with these lightweight power supplies that they even, of course, offered to all TAM is, of course, they raised the frequency up so that they reduced the copper rate. The old original power supplies, you know, that when, you know, we first started getting into all the solid-state jazz, you had a hefty power transformer. You had to take the 110 volts, you dropped it immediately to 12 or so, 13, 14 volts immediately down, and the transformer has to, you know, be able to handle the current that you eventually wound up at the output. You needed at 60 cycles, that transformer was heavy. So this is where the lightweight transformers came in, basically. Go ahead, Dick.
Now, when it comes to the transformer driven single-ended with a single transistor, to do the output voltage regulating, it could run at a constant frequency and change the pulse width, or it could use a quasi-constant pulse width and change the frequency. In either case, you're changing the duty cycle and therefore the current output capability. The particular regulator chip that you were using, was it a combination of width and frequency, or was it pure constant frequency, variable width, or vice versa? If you happen to know, Mel, go ahead.
The chip, yeah, well, everything is, like you say, in the chip there. It works very well. It's a sophisticated little chip. I'll tell you how well it, you know, regulates. And I don't know its architecture exactly. It's pulse width. You can see it. If you look at it on the scope, you can see what's happening, definitely. And, of course, you've got to, you sense the output, basically, and it comes back to this chip of you, and that's what, in other words, it's very quick, because you can go like you're talking in a mic, and it picks up the difference from a few hundred mils, and you then, of course, talking to the mic, and over you're drawing 15 amps, and it's amazing the regulation, how tight it is take on a thing like this. I don't know the exact architecture of the IC, but it's the most likely classic, it looks like a classic PWM stick, over.
You got it, Clint.
Yeah, typically the port converter or the single transformer type of device is normally fixed frequency variable duty cycle, reason being that if you just vary the duty cycle, the frequency is fixed, the flux density reaches just a peak maximum, you don't have to worry about transformer saturation. When you vary the frequency into a transformer design, you have to monitor the primary current. If the frequency drops too low, below a certain point, eventually now you have to worry about transformer saturation. It's one of the typical things that usually the computer power supplies are very cheap and inexpensive effective.
That makes a lot of sense. And since the frequency is fixed and since there is a maximum pulse width you can go to before saturating the transformer, to get his increased current output, Mel probably had to go to a slightly larger core to make sure the core doesn't saturate when he's drawing 35 amps when it previously was only dishing out a maximum of 15 amps, we'll say. Did you approximately double the cross-sectional area of the core, Mel, with your transformer redesign? And did you do it with if you were rewinding somewhat like Manfred's article? Go ahead.
Exactly. I did it exactly with the copper wrap, the thin copper flashing. You know, they sell this copper flashing. I went into this guy, the roofing, and I asked him. He said, yeah, he said, I got some scraps that they, you know, they don't throw copper scrap away at all anymore. No matter what it is, the way copper has gone through the prices. So he's got this copper, they use it, it's very thin, it's actually aluminum, like you would have, aluminum for wrapping in a kitchen, but this is the copper version of it, Dick, and I use that to, make up that transformer the way he suggested it. It takes a little work, and I'll use, that number 14, secondary and everything, the winded, that on there with the primary of number 36, not big deal, but the winded secondary with number 14 solid copper, honestly, that thing takes a little ingenuity, over.
If you like, there's one more comment.
Yeah, I've got a question now when it comes to you. Was the copper flashing used as a primary or secondary winding? It sounds like you've got real form ball wire as the primary winding and the secondary winding. You could make a primary or secondary out of copper flashing with some kind of fish paper in between. He'll explain that when it comes to you. Gordon, you got it. I mean, Glenn, you got it.
Just a quick thing about the transformers magnetic. The outfitting doctor, you have to increase the cross-sectional area and the volume of the core as the current increases because the H field is going to be larger and need more area. The transformer, the cross-sectional area, if you increase current, doesn't have to increase. As long as the volt seconds are the same, and the peak voltage is the same in the transformer, the cross-sectional area is the same. The only thing you have to do is increase the wire area so you can get more copper in there to create the same amount of power, the increased power, excuse me.
Okay, the number of joules per cycle that are delivered is a function of voltage output and current output. He wants the same voltage at twice the current, therefore he's asking for twice the number of joules per cycle. To do that, I think, requires twice the stored energy, one half Li squared, in the magnetic field. Did I go wrong on that one? Go ahead.
Yes. Actually, that's only true in the what they call the flyback design, where you store energy in the transformer and release it during the off cycle. In the forward converter or bridge configuration of the transformer, it's a voltage coupling, so therefore you're not storing energy, you're just coupling it on cycle in time. Thank you, Nick.
Okay, then there must be a damper network because the transformer is now flying back during the non-conducting cycle of the output diodes. Is that true?
Only for the leakage inductance. Anything that's non-coupled would have to stop.
By the way, Mel, one of the things that was brought to my attention by Gordon, W2TTT, the man who runs the ARA, Bergenfield Amateur Radio Association TechNet, on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, is that the January issue of CQ Magazine in the editorial page, the TechNet of Barra and the TechNet on Limon are described. So if you get CQ Magazine, or if you go to, if you Google CQ Magazine and you find the CQ site, you can download the editorial page for the January issue. And you'll read about the TechNet on Limark. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna repeat it pretty soon. All right, I'll take a look at it. I hope they gave a favorable report there. Dick, Chief Mark, maybe at least a C chai. No, really. Yeah, well, winding it was a bit of a problem and all. I followed those directions there. And all, and I had to get that was the only thing, was getting those material together. And, all right, it took a little doing, you know, to put it together. But the end result was, gee, it's a terrific power supply. I can really think of it as the best you're going to be able to buy for that price. Well, for that price, you're never going to be able to buy anything. But, it wasn't as complicated, so the situation was I just wanted, you know, something with a little bit beefed up output. But if you just want, the bottom line is if you just need something to run up to 100 watt rig or so, using that power supply from one of those old computers makes for an excellent, you know, supply. You can have a bunch of them around, you know, if you need it once and then dose it out. I don't know about paralleling up. You brought up a good question. Can you parallel up switching power supply with one pull, the other one push, or whatever? Maybe you can give me an answer to that, Dick. Have you ever tried that? Over.
It's a little bit similar to trying to parallel car batteries. You got to be careful. In the case of car batteries, if you want twice as much current and stored energy and whatever, common sense would say you just put the two batteries in parallel. For a temporary deal, like just doing it during a field day operation, you might get away with it. But if you left two car batteries in parallel for a long period of time, one always has a little bit higher voltage than the other, and it's always dumping current into the other one, and they cycle back and forth, and they drain themselves to ground. So unless you've got a diode or a network on the output, which gives you a few tenths of a volt drop continuously, unless you've got a diode or a network, you do not put car batteries in parallel. By the same token, if you take these two highly regulated power supplies, where each one's trying to maintain the output voltage to the nearest millivolt, obviously one of them is going to be drawing the current most of the time, and if it had a current limiting capability built in, so that when you draw, let's assume that each power supply is capable of 15 amperes, and even though one of them is working real hard up to 15 amperes, and if it goes into current limiting, and it doesn't try to dish out more than 15, and then the other one takes over, that would be a beautiful thing. So if you've got a real current limiting characteristic built in, then putting them in parallel would work. Other than that, some kind of a load sharing network is required. So putting power supplies that are highly regulated in parallel can be a little bit tricky. I think it's doable. Glenn's probably been there, and Glenn's going to tell us how he does it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the second half.
Thanks. Just by hitting it a bit on this one, we've jumped in. A really nice way to do this, especially with computer power supplies, is you probably noticed that the regulation really isn't that great. There's a certain percentage of droop that you're going to see on the output. So if you draw a load and you know what the droop is out of each power supply, and they're similar, and you look at the percentage of volt drop as you pull load current, if you connect the wires of the two power supplies together such that they both droop at the same voltage amount per unit of current that's being pulled out of each power supply, and they pull together, they'll both share. So if you can control that either with a small resistor on the output, the diode like pixels, or the diode's a little on the funky side, then sometimes it's better just to watch the regulation of the power supplies and see if they're compatible and if the wire lengths coming at each one are of an equal length where you join the two power supplies together. So they regulate at the same point, and then just measure the current on both sides to see that both power supplies are sharing as you pull load. Generally, it'll work okay. It's a cheap and dirty way of doing it, but I've done it, and it does work.
Glenn, do you believe any of those computer power supplies have a remote voltage sense capability? Go ahead.
Some do, but they're not easily accessible. If they are available on the connector, the thing to do there would be to tie the voltage sense as close back to power supply as possible, then run the load cables from each power supply away to a remote point where you can get them to share. The problem is if you attach the voltage sensors at the same point, then they're both going to try to regulate the same point together, and then you'll have very, very poor sharing conditions. Back to you.
Where you care most is what voltage is delivered through the connector on the back of the rig. If you can remotely sense voltage delivered to the rig, wouldn't that give you the best regulation at the rig itself? Go ahead.
Absolutely. If you let it go right to the rig, you're going to get the best. But if you're going to try to parallel two power supplies, the problem is they won't share because they're going to both try to make that power supply their programmed control voltage, which may not be exactly the same. So as you said, you're going to have the strongest sister supplying all the load, the other one won't. Where if you allow just a small amount of throughput, which it could be very controlled, it could be just a few hundred millivolts, but as long as those control lines are back at the individual power supplies where you sum them together, you can get them to share.
I see where you're going here. Rather than put in a 50th of an ohm resistor at the junction point of the two power supplies, let the wiring supply that for you. So power supply A has his wire going all the way to the rig, power supply B has his wire going all the way to the rig, and now those two wires are only joined at the rig. Now the droop in that wiring forces the power supplies to come much closer to sharing the current. I think that's what you're saying. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Except in this particular case where you want them to share and you're not sure that the current limit's going to protect you in case one goes to full load and the other one doesn't jump in right away, the best way to control it is that if you have two power supplies, you want to put them in a box, control the wire length so you get both of them to share at full load. When you pull the maximum load, they're both sharing and protecting each other. And then what you can do is make a connector right there or a binding post where you strap them all together. So this way now when you connect any kind of universal load on the output and draw it, you don't have to worry about having not properly matched links going out to the radio itself.
This reminds me a little bit of a high-power amplifier I've been working on recently where the current sensing resistors are 1/100th of an ohm resistors. I think they were 1206 type chip resistors, a hundredth of an ohm. And for a reason that I needed to bypass that function, I had to short those out. And boy, you got to be careful to find a big enough chunk of copper to short that out, otherwise you're not doing anything. We've run out of time. The machine's going to be shut down in about 60 seconds now. This was TechNet number 1169 of the series that began in September of 1982. 25 and a fraction years ago. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel and I will be back next week. Mel, why don't you tie the ribbons on it? KQRIW.
Hey, thank you very much, everybody. Yes, very interesting. That's a good idea. That would be a great idea. Maybe take a couple of power supplies, the identical ones. Put them in one box, power them up, similar to what was just described, and maybe you could have yourself one heck of a nice power supply for, like you say, literally very little or nothing. All right. Anyhow, a lot of fun to experiment. A lot of these things you find in the street, you can do so much with this stuff that you walk by and say, worthless. But be amazed how many things hands can adapt. 73 ball. We'll see you all next week. Good night. Take care. This is KQKY.
The time is 12 a.m. 73 and you'll think from the W2L repeater.